This is the BBC Home Service. Kanchenjunga, 1955. The world's third highest mountain had a unique reputation for difficulty and danger. It was summed up by Sir John Hunt saying that to climb Kanchenjunga would be the greatest feat in mountaineering, involving technical climbing problems and dangers greater than on Everest. Dürrenfurt, in a recent book, condemned all the faces of Kanchenjunga, and Frank Smythe had specifically called the Yalung face unjustifiable and too dangerous by reason of avalanches. Members of the British expedition, led by Dr. Charles Evans, who succeeded against these odds, are here in the studio to tell their story. Kanchenjunga, 1955. Dr. Evans.
It's true that when I got a telegram asking me to lead this expedition, my feeling was that Kanchenjunga was too hard and too dangerous for anyone to get up it. I'd never even examined the problem seriously before I was asked to go, but Kemp and Lewis had recently had a look at the Yalung face and had the idea that there might be a route. When I'd read their reports, it didn't seem a very strong hope, but the only way was to go and have a look. Our reconnaissance was to be a strong one. I chose a team of nine, and six of them had been in the Himalaya before. We had the advantage of all the equipment developed on Everest, with modifications and improvements in the light of Everest experience, for instance, a less clumsy boot, and oxygen apparatus with a bigger capacity for its weight. We called the expedition a reconnaissance, and our first aim was to reach the great shelf on the Yalung face. But we had all made up our minds that if we did get up to the shelf, we were having a go at the top. After the long months of preparation, and just before we were to sail, we suddenly heard that we might not be allowed to go to the mountain at all. Kanchenjunga lies about 80 miles east of Everest, on the border between Nepal and the semi-autonomous Indian state of Sikkim. The Sikkimese look upon it as a protective deity, holy and unconquerable. Well, they naturally didn't want anybody to conquer it. This doubt hung over us on the voyage out, and until I went to Gangtok to negotiate with the rulers of Sikkim. Then we promised not to go beyond the point on the mountain where we were sure of a route to the top, and we promised also not to desecrate the immediate neighbourhood of the summit. This seemed to satisfy both sides. It was from Darjeeling that we had our first view of Kanchenjunga, only 45 miles away to the northwest. We were all impressed, but Neil Mather, who was seeing it for the first time, can describe it.
We saw it for just a few minutes, I remember, not long. It was about 7 o'clock in the morning. It looked unreal to me. It was so much higher than anything else. There was a band of cloud, and Kanchenjunga seemed to be floating in the sky above it. It was remote and rather frightening by the sheer scale of it.
We could see the West Ridge and the upper part of the great Yalung face, but they were still far away. It wasn't until 2 weeks later that we saw the real difficulties and dangers of our route at close quarters, from Corner Camp, right under the face itself. Tom McKinnon and I had put a camp on the crest of a moraine where the Yalung Glacier bends round to the right, to the east. It was a dramatic place. We could look down south onto the desolate glacier up which we had come, a wilderness of boulders and ice, and for the first time we could see the whole Yalung face at the head of a glaciated kum, 10,000 feet of it from top to bottom. George Band, who saw it soon afterwards, compared it, as I did, with the West Kum on Everest.
Yes, the scenery was so awe-inspiring that I felt even smaller than in the Western Kum. There was a magnificent array of peaks around us, and all the mountain faces were daubed with masses of hanging ice, discharging their debris into the high snow basins feeding the glacier which curved round below us.
We could pick out the details of the Yalung face itself, and I want to try to describe them to you. The most prominent feature is an ice terrace, the great shelf. stretching right across the face at about 24,000 feet. Directly below the shelf, there are huge rock precipices, constantly swept by avalanches from the shelf. To the left of this wall, a long and steep icefall climbs up to the shelf. We could see a rocky buttress to the right of its lower part, the buttress Kemp thought we might use to avoid the lowest part of the icefall. A little higher, at 20,000 feet, we could see a flattish ice basin, and then the upper icefall going up to the left-hand end of the great shelf. The shelf was far above us, 7,000 feet up. Beyond it, we could see the red rocks of the summit and the sloping gangway of snow that leads to the west ridge. All the time, the clouds raced across the summit ridges, and the wind made a continuous, far-off roar like a great waterfall. We planned to put our base camp at the foot of the icefall, and Mackinnon and I had come to find the way to it.
The glacier was a maze of broken ice and heavy snow at this season, which made it very tiring. At least three attempts were made before we found a route to base, and the last was a very long day, because we had to return to Corner Camp.
The day after that, we were resting in the morning at Corner Camp. The wind was strong, and it grew stronger every minute, and was shaking our tents violently. Suddenly there was a great flapping, and something brushed across the outside of my tent. There was a shout, "The big dome's gone," and we rushed out to look. There was no sign of the big tent. Where it had been, there were two small Sherpas curled up in their sleeping bags. They put their heads out, looked round, and then put them back in again. Joe Brown and I went to look for the tent and found it in a hollow 200 yards away. Although it weighed 80 pounds, it had been carried bodily, metal framework and all, leaving no trace on the ground between. This smack in the eye forced most of us to abandon Corner Camp until our tentage was mended. But we had learnt a lot, and we now knew that coolies couldn't do the carry to base camp. Dar Tenzing, head of our Sherpas, whose dignified bearing has got him the title of King of the Sherpas, summed it all up by saying, "They are not good, the gods of Kanchenjunga." But slowly the gods relented. The snow began to go, and the spring flowers to come up. Not that the business of stocking Corner Camp with supplies was ever a great pleasure, as John Clegg will tell you.
Yes, it was my idea of hell, and deadly dull into the bargain. You were walking on sharp-edged boulders that kept slipping from under you, up and down the whole time, and feeling that you were getting absolutely nowhere.
But everyone played their part in helping the Sherpas to get the supplies up. It was in this period that the photographs arrived. Photographs taken for us by the Indian Air Force. They made the final ridge look even worse than we had feared. It was a jagged knife edge with tremendous cliffs on each side.
Most of the party were assembled at Moraine Camp, I remember. Charles said we all might as well go back to Darjeeling now. He was joking, but we were all rather depressed, although this depression didn't last very long.
The route to base camp was formidable. It was much harder than is usual on the way to a base camp. We had to find a route away from the avalanches which fall from Talang Peak, and this forced us into a maze of crevasses and ice walls. It was like getting to Camp 1 on the Everest icefall. But gradually we transformed it, until at the end John Jackson was able to say you could wheel a pram along it. Base camp at 17,500 feet was pretty safe. Though when he was first there with me, George Band amused himself by chalking up the avalanches that we could hear all the time.
For the first 24 hours, the weather was awful. We didn't get out, and I chalked up 48 avalanches in that time. I was asleep for about a third of it, so that works out at about one avalanche every 20 minutes.
We were now at last at the foot of the Yalung face. And in the last 2 weeks of April, George Band and Norman Hardy began to explore Kemp's route. With their Sherpas, they put a camp on top of the rock buttress. But the real difficulties and dangers only begin here in the top of the lower icefall. George will tell you what it was like.
We spent 3 days struggling with the icefall itself, and my impression was that it made the Kumbul icefall on Everest look like a pile of children's bricks in a playground. It was far more dangerous. I remember fantastic arches and great blocks poised to crash, and smaller blocks frozen together above you like crystal chandeliers. At length, we were barred from the top of this lower icefall by a line of vertical ice cliffs, about 50 feet high, which seemed to go right across it. Norman and I found only one place where this wall seemed possible. We spent 4 hours making only 20 feet of height up it, cutting footholds and handholds along a thin sloping rake, and putting in pitons, those are steel pegs, every few feet along the rake. It was exhausting work at 20,000 feet, for the wall was pushing your body out all the time. Norman had done the major part as the most experienced ice climber, but it was getting harder all the time and taking longer. "Let's try artificial," I said. "This is a very strenuous technique, using a doubled rope and rope stirrups where the footholds are lacking. The leader hammers pitons into suitable cracks above him, clips the rope to them by a snap link, and the second man assists by hauling on the rope from down below. Soon, Norman was playing me from below, dangling, as he put it, like a puppet on strings. I remember him shouting, 'Put your other foot on something, George, for God's sake.' At last, I found a crack for the final crucial piton. It wasn't in firmly. I could take it out with my hand, but it was safe for a gentle downward pull. I balanced carefully across to reach a shallow scoop, which I had chipped with my piton hammer. Then, holding my breath with apprehension, I eased over, pulled up onto a sloping, snow-slimy ledge, and rolled in the slush, gasping for air. We were up.
In spite of George's exhilaration at the climbing on this pitch, certainly the hardest technically on the expedition, the whole party now realized that this route was too difficult and far too dangerous for Sherpas with loads. So our first real brush with the Yalung face was a failure and a bitter disappointment. We hadn't even found a route up the lower icefall. Fortunately, Norman Hardy had noticed another possibility, a last hope. To the left, across the lower icefall, was another rock buttress. We called it the Western Rock Buttress to distinguish it from Kemp's. From the crest of it, a small, narrow glacier comes down to join the top of this lower icefall that had defeated us. This small glacier was the key. If we could reach the top of the Western Rock Buttress and come down the tributary glacier, we might yet reach the foot of the upper icefall. A week later, the same pair, Band and Hardy, had found a route up the glaciated slopes on the west side of the Western Buttress, and discovered a place for Camp 2 at the top of the lower icefall. The way was open to the upper icefall. Joe Brown and I were to explore it, while the main body was improving the route to Camp 2. We started by being snowed up for 2 days in daily storms. We tried to return to base because of lack of food. And Joe Brown will tell you what happened on the treacherous slopes below the hump when we tried to come down them.
We started off down this and the snow was waist deep. The angle at the top was probably about 40 degrees or perhaps slightly less. And I was leading downwards and suddenly there was a cracking noise in the snow, which is the usual thing that happens before an avalanche occurs. And I stopped, and I think Charles hadn't heard this, and he thought probably that I was tiring, so he decided to take the lead. And as he was passing me, the weight of two of us on one point caused the snow to crack again, and a crack appeared in the snow that run out for quite a few yards in each direction and probably opened about 2 inches. And we both stood there looking at one another for a few seconds and then turned round and ran back up the way we'd come, just regardless of lack of oxygen. Usually we went up that stretch at a very slow pace, but managed to go up it at quite a reasonable speed.
As far as I remember, it was the sort of speed that would have beaten the 4-minute mile. In the next 10 days, we tackled the problems of the steep slopes of the upper ice fall. Halfway up, we placed Camp 3, under a great overhanging wall of ice. It was on a platform 40 feet long and 15 feet wide. Later on, the steep ice leading up to it was festooned with ropes and rope ladders. From this camp, Hardy and I set off with 2 Sherpas, using oxygen, to try to reach the great shelf itself. But after 5 hours at 23,500 feet, we found ourselves cut off from it still by a zone of big crevasses and ice towers, or seracs. We camped there, Camp 4, without knowing whether we could reach the shelf or not. Next day, we found a huge whaleback of a serac. After cutting right along it, we found a clear passage through to the great shelf. We were on the shelf at last. To our joy, the gradient here was easy. The snow, beautifully smooth and practically uncrevassed. We looked across these easy slopes till they steepened up against the final rocky wall of the mountain. There were still 5,000 feet to go to the top, and we studied the steep, white snow and ice corridor, the gangway, which might lead us onto the summit ridge. That day, we found a place for Camp 5, on a ledge the size of a big table near the foot of the gangway. It was at 25,300 feet. It was protected from avalanche by an ice cliff, and for us, it was the equivalent of the South Col on Everest. This was a great day for the expedition, for nothing could stop us now from making an attempt on the final ridge. We went back down to base camp and made our last plans for the final effort. It was hard to choose 2 summit teams because everyone was going well enough to deserve a place in them. The first vital job was leading 10 Sherpas to carry equipment to Camp 5, and I asked Tom McKinnon and John Jackson to do this. Heavily loaded, they reached Camp 4 on May the 18th, and the next morning, after a windy night, some of the Sherpas were reluctant to go on. To make matters worse, John Jackson had spent a sleepless night with developing snow blindness.
Yes, my eyes began to burn soon after dark, and I can remember most of the night kneeling in the sleeping bag with my head down because of the pain. It felt as if powdered glass had got under my eyelids. I groped about blindly for anything cool, like the rubber of an oxygen mask, which I could put against my eyes to ease the burning. But really, my worry all the time was that I would find myself totally blind and out of the carry next day. When light did come, it looked as if the whole tent was filled with smoke. Outside, everything was a blur and a dazzle. I did find, though, that by taping my snow goggles with black sticky tape to make narrow slits, I could begin to make things out fairly clearly 2 or 3 feet away.
Somehow we persuaded the Sherpas to start. With Jacko tied in the middle of one rope, stooping low and groping his way from step to step, 5 Sherpas reached Camp 5, and there we set up a tent. But 4, who were behind and nearing exhaustion, had to dump their loads on the steep slope before the camp, or risk being benighted. 1, early in the day, had dropped his load into a crevasse. All alone and overcome with shame, he stayed to recover it and struggled on as high as he could.
It was a tough and crucial day. Waiting with Mather and the first assault pair, Brown and Band, at Camp 4, I saw the Camp 5 carry return late in the afternoon, Jacko still groping between 2 Sherpas, and Tom bringing 1 very tired Sherpa he'd just hauled out of a crevasse. That night, we heard, as usual, the wind screaming across the barren site of our camp and the snow battering on the canvas of the tents. But it wasn't merely driven snow this time, it was a raging blizzard. Neil Mather was getting his first experience of being snowed up in a high camp.
The snow was constantly piling up round the walls of the tent, and we could feel the weight of it against them. Our breath condensed on the inside of the tent and froze, and then the wind blew it on top of us, so we were covered in what looked like snowflakes, and we were 3 huddled mounds of snow in each 2-man tent.
The blizzard lasted all that day, throughout the night, and the whole of the next day.
I remember Joe Brown putting out his head and saying, "Another ruddy white Christmas."
It was an anxious time, as we were cutting down on our reserves. But after the third night, the weather changed, and we dug out our equipment and toiled slowly upwards with new snow up to our knees. Within 400 feet of Camp 5, we suddenly found ourselves wading through the debris of a new snow avalanche. Above us, we could see sticking out of the snow a Primus stove, a bit of a tent, and then an oxygen bottle. We added what we could of these to our loads and struggled on, panting. We were too tired by now to take in properly the seriousness of what had happened, but between us and Camp 5, where our dump had been, the ice was swept bare. It was empty, no sign of our dump. When we got to 5, instead of a neatly pitched tent, we saw only the top of the tent sticking out above the avalanche snow. It had covered the shelf, too. There was no sign of any kerosene, no oxygen, no food, nothing else at all. And the next 2 hours were the worst of all, and the lashing wind drove snow into our faces as we tried to dig our gear out of the snow.
We were completely done in. The last 20 feet to the camp went down a slight incline, and I more or less flopped down this. I could hardly hold myself up, and Charles rushed over and clapped an oxygen mask over my face.
And then the dusk came on, and it was desperately cold. Every movement to dig or to pull on the tents made us pant furiously. I remember hanging on to 2 tents that the wind swept together into the air. It was like flying a couple of kites.
And all the time, the wind came in tremendous gusts, and as we stuck our tent pegs in, they were whipped out again.
But we got the tents up at last and crawled into our bags. Next day we rested, but early on the following day we started in extreme cold and worked our way up the gangway itself. We were breaking now into completely new territory, cutting steps all the way, and even our tiredness didn't spoil our growing excitement. After 5 hours of this, our oxygen began to give out. I would cut a step, then have to stop for 20 breaths, then another step, and so it went on. Slowly, step by step, it was hard to find any place to put the tent on these unrelieved snow slopes. We had to dig out a ledge in the snow beside some slabs of rock. The slightest movement had us gasping like fish. And then George Band found an unused bottle of oxygen and amazed us all with his sudden vigour. Even then, the platform wasn't wide enough for the tent, which overhung the edge by 6 inches. In that last camp, at nearly 27,000 feet, Mather and I left Joe and George and started off to get down before dark.
Joe and I drew matchsticks, and I lost, which meant that I got the outside sleeping position. Just to be on the safe side, we kept ourselves roped up that night, and the rope went out of the tent and was tied to a little rock spike nearby. We didn't sleep too badly. I remember hearing fitfully the skittering of bits of snow down the slope onto our tent, and wondering to myself, is a snowfall beginning? But in the morning the weather was good as we set off up the gangway above. We tried to break out to the right too soon, and wasted an hour and a half of time and of oxygen. As the ground steepened, I remember a difficult rock pitch. It was an awkward corner, and there was nothing for your feet. You just had to swing round on your hands. Just above was an impressive ice slope, 60 degrees in places. This would be quite steep, even in the Alps, and it certainly is steep in the Himalayas. You'd go a long way if you both fell off together, at least 2,000 feet before you stopped. When we reached the ridge itself, we'd been going 4 to 5 hours without any rest, except where we'd been safeguarding each other. And then, along the ridge, each step hid the one behind. At last, in front of us, we saw a nose of rock, steep and smooth. Turning right below it, we saw that there were several broken vertical cracks in the 20-foot wall above, and there was an overhang to finish. Joe looked at it.
I knew that at sea level I could do that thing quite easily, but at that height, you just don't know how long your strength's going to last if you have to hang by your arms for any length of time, you just might just fall off with exhaustion.
Then I watched Joe leading up, putting a fist into the cracks and jamming it, then pulling up, and safeguarding himself with a sling round a stone jammed into the crack. I remember him shouting down, "George, we're there!" When I joined him, we were together on snow, and the snow sloped gently to the summit, 15 feet away, and 5 feet above the ground on which we stood. That was as far as we had allowed ourselves to go. On the way down, we were tired, our oxygen was finished, and we were late. I was crossing a patch of unstable snow. Suddenly, a foothold broke. I slipped and rolled over onto my stomach and dug my axe into the snow. I stopped myself and lay there panting. And Joe said, "Gosh, it makes me tired just to look at that."
Tony Strather and Norman Hardy, the second summit pair, had come up by now and were waiting for them. I know you were a bit anxious, weren't you, Tony?
Yes, indeed, Charles. When George and Joe came down to Camp 6, it was very late. Joe was snowblind, and George had frostbitten fingers. There was so much to be done, we didn't have time to show our enthusiasm about it all. We had to pack the four of us into the tiny tent overlapping the edge. George and Joe insisted, after a long argument, that we should have the sleeping bags, for we had a hard day in front of us.
I was again on the outside position. They said I got used to it by now. The sewing of the canvas was creaking in the night, and I remember thinking, supposing the stitching goes.
The next day, the second pair set out to follow the same route. Tony Strather recalls two incidents.
The worst was the first one. Norman was leading, and I shouted to him to stop, for I had noticed that his windproof was loose on the frame of his oxygen. He stopped and went to swing the frame off his back, and as he did so, his large oxygen cylinder slid out of its straps and went sliding down the mountain. The valve was knocked open, and I can still remember the cylinder hissing as it rushed down the face and out of sight. So we had to share our remaining oxygen and go on a low flow rate. Well, at last we came to this rock pitch at the top. George and Joe had told us all about it, about the hand jamming, slings and pegs, and how very difficult it was. And I had been quite terrified at the idea of it. When we got there, we looked up and didn't like the look of it any better than they had. So we went on round the wall for about 15 yards, and there, to our surprise, we found a perfect little snow ridge running right up to the summit. We remained on the summit for about an hour, and then I remember coming down and meeting Charles at Camp 5. Charles shouted up to us, "Have you been to the top?" It didn't seem necessary to answer. A little closer, Norman shouted to Charles, "Who won the election?" Charles didn't answer that one either. When we reached him, he didn't say anything, but just took cine pictures of us. He thrust a bottle of lemonade into our hands and said, "Hey, drink this." Then there was more cine. Then at the end, he just patted us on the back and said, "Well done." The only sad thing was when he told us about the death of Pema Dorje, one of our Sherpas. He had died just about the same time that we had reached the summit, and the Sherpas were saying that the gods of Kanchenjunga had not let us get away with it scot-free, after all.
Pema Dorje died of a cerebral thrombosis at base camp. It wasn't a climbing accident. He was young and likable and keen, always grinning from year to year, with a mass of long hair, wild and untidy. His loss was the one cloud on our happiness. Our happiness at finding, against all expectation, a route to the top, and our happiness that we had become a team of close friends while sharing in this success.
The members of the team on the Kanchenjunga expedition were Charles Evans, surgeon from Liverpool, George Band, geologist from Cambridge, Joe Brown, plumber from Manchester, John Jackson, schoolteacher from Lancashire, Tom McKinnon, pharmacist from Glasgow, Neil Mather, textile researcher from Manchester, Tony Strether, regular soldier from the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst, Dr. John Clegg, anatomist from Sheffield, and Norman Hardy, engineer from New Zealand. The broadcast was by arrangement with The Times and with the Alpine Club and the Royal Geographical Society, who sponsored the expedition.